Hello and welcome to No Killing Goblins, the Wandering Inn fan podcast. I'm Dragonus, as always, with Oshi,
Hi, everybody.
who has now successfully recovered from having the plague.
It wasn't terrible. It could have been much worse. I got COVID in January and I was like down for a month.
Yeah, I've only had it once so far, knock on wood. If I have wood nearby, I do not, so I guess I'm getting the Rona sometime soon.
Oh, God. It's going around. Literally half my family ended up. It's going to happen to you at some point. Be prepared for the stomach aches.
I'd have to go outside and interact with people more often, which, admittedly, I'm starting to do with more in-person gaming.
Yeah. I miss in-person gaming.
It's nice. There's just something to running in person, at least for me. I'm an in-person DM. I flail my arms, I jump out of my seat, I mime people murdering each other. Like, it's just a totally different experience than when I run online.
I don't know. Running online can be easier in some ways because I'm able to do other things and just keep myself engaged. Because in the real world, you kind of get... There's not a lot of ways to stay engaged if you're bored, which kind of sucks.
If I'm running, then, you know, I'm engaged the whole way through. If I'm playing, or if like, somebody's in a game that I'm running in person, then sort of, you know, my goal and one of the reasons why I can be so bombastic is to help keep people engaged. Online, yeah, keeping people engaged can be a bit of a struggle. We even had a whole issue with one of my players who was a bit of a WoW addict at the time, like trying to raid at the same time we were having combats, and it was kind of hilarious in retrospect. But
I can understand like playing a game of League or something in the background, but raiding? That's a lot. Well, that's a bit much.
I've got a personal philosophy that if it can't be paused, I don't want to play it if I'm playing online, but that's just me. That's usually, you know, what I tell people that I'm running for. Plus, I just picked up Star Wars Legion, so, you know, I spent more money on more gray plastic. There's more chances to get COVID.
Okay, so I was going to ask you how your week's been, because mine has been COVID-filled, so I can't really talk about anything else.
My week has kind of been exactly that. I recently bought into Star Wars Legion. Most of my free time has been getting it glued together and primed. I am also busy with work and I hate my job. That's about life.
That sounds about right. I guess TWI-wise, there hasn't been a lot of news because Pirate's been on break. Actual vacation for the last couple of weeks.
A very well-deserved, much-appreciated vacation.
Sure, whatever. There are many hands that needed to rest.
I'm sorry, did you just confirm Pirate does secretly have four hands? Because that's a theory that I've had for a while.
How would I know? I'm just saying.
I don't know how you'd know, but you said there was many hands, and now I'm wondering how many hands Pirate actually has.
Dragonus, this is how rumors start. You know? This is how in high school I ended up being, like, the guy who said this girl kicked a dog. Like, what the fuck? Like, okay, I'm still mad about that.
Well, I mean, she did kick the dog, presumably.
No, she didn't!
Well, then why'd you say she kicked a dog, Oshi?
You know what? You fuck you. Fuck you, that's what... God, this is all high school. Okay, so we did get some reader email this week. So we're going to do that instead of talking about books, because I forgot to pick a book. And I did not tell Dragonus.
I mean, I have many, many books. But I will go ahead and also talk a bit about some reader emails, because we did get a couple in.
Yeah, we could do reader emails. I mean, I could talk about a book, too, if we're okay with that. I think you've probably read this one.
Which one?
Catherine Addison's The Goblin Emperor.
I don't think I have.
You have not read The Goblin Emperor? Okay, let's get through the reader emails, and if we have time, we'll talk about The Goblin Emperor. You go ahead.
It sounds familiar. You definitely should tell me about it, because I do not think I've ever read it. But we got an email in from Seth, talked a little bit about episodes 36 and 37. I will say, though, for episode 37, that's when we talked a bit about the Honorverse series. And Seth says, "The Honorverse series is great if you like very long and technical descriptions on tactics and how the ships slash sci-fi technology is built slash works. One thing that really makes them hard to get into, though, is that only some of them have glossaries, so it can be a bit confusing if you put it down for a while and forget what all the acronyms are. I'm inclined to agree. At this point, I've read and reread them so often that, like, that's not really a risk for me, but for somebody new coming in, I can imagine that being a real problem. That said, since all of the books are literally given away by Bane free online, you probably could always just pick up a digital copy as long as you got it downloaded. The other thing Seth mentions here is talking about military novels and the things they tie into, and alternate history stuff, which he feels is a precursor to Western isekai in his opinion, as some of them involve groups of people, sometimes a military unit, which are teleported to an alternative Earth or are abducted or sent back in time. Some decent contenders in this include the SM Sterling Emberverse and Nantucket series, in which technology is rendered inert in one series and the entire island of Nantucket is sent to the Bronze Age in the other. Those are also the same series, weirdly enough, like the Nantucket thing and technology turning off were related. It has been a long time since I've really thought about it.
Yes.
And Taylor Anderson's Destroyer Man series, in which a World War II coal-powered destroyer boat in the Pacific Navy is transported to an alternative Earth and must join up with sentient lemurs to fight sentient dinosaur-like raptors. That is a great series. I also recommend it to everyone. I will say, though, Seth, those aren't the precursor to Western isekai. In fact, the first isekai was a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, which is also the precursor to most Western isekai, as it is the precursor to all isekai.
Okay, you know what? I have an argument against that.
What's your argument against that?
The Connecticut Yankee, technically, it is time travel to the same period, not to a different world, and the basis of isekai is that you're either transported or reincarnated into another world.
Sure, but aside from that one minor quibble, it is a story where a person is sent to another time period or place where they use their specific advanced knowledge of both the future and or of, advanced scientific and engineering to become radically overpowered and involved in the world around them and politically important. And it hits every other button. Like, in every way, it is an isekai.
Except, though, except, and I'm gonna be the asshole troll to you because I've been asshole trolled the last couple of months, and somebody has to get my revenge. Isekai, the basis of the modern terminology, is the concept of being transported to another world. It's not a minor quibble, it's in fact the entire basis of the genre.
Then you have just cut out roughly half of all trapped in an MMO isekai as well.
Yes, I have.
Because you're wrong.
And here's why I think this is true. Because current isekai never do trapped in an MMO anymore. They almost always transition to get transported to another world, reincarnated. It's not trapped in an MMO anymore. Because it was the precursor to the current isekai.
Even if you want to say that you don't think Connecticut Yankee in the King Arthur's Court is the first isekai, which admittedly there might be similar stories that come before it, but most of like the story beats in it, I feel, are pretty unique to it at the time it came out. There's no denying that the bones of that story exist in every isekai.
I would say there are more recent examples of transported to another world. Portal Fantasy is what I would go with, and my personal starting point, even though it's a little strange, would actually be L. Frank Baum's Weirdo Ass.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Although, God, I actually thought the Connecticut Yankee came out before Oz. Do I have my time periods wrong?
No. I believe Connecticut Yankee came out before, because Twain was before Brom. But I'm saying that Dorothy's novels fit the whole isekai thing without any quibbles, whereas Connecticut Yankee thing is more time travel. There's some give there to both of it, but you get what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's just I think both are isekai. And actually, now that you mention it, the Oz stuff feels like it's the precursor to the modern cheat item isekai, where you get trapped in another world, but you have a cheat, right? You have the ruby slippers, or you
Exactly.
get trapped in another world and you just happen to have the correct knowledge and the correct understanding of modern sociology, engineering, whatever the overpowered thing is, that then lets you.
The thing that makes me like, sorry, complete your thought and then I'll stop talking.
Well, I'm just saying that, like, that they're largely, if you wanted to be reductive, isekai boiled down mostly into those two different sectors of thing, And I think that the Oz ones do really feel like there was a lot of inspiration of those to be found over in the cheat item stuff. But both of them are isekai.
Okay, and fine, I'm good with that. But my quibbles are my quibbles. What I was going to mention, though, is it's always nice to remember that we're looking at this from a perspective of Western examples and precursors to what already existed in Eastern examples, which came from a completely different source because there is a different literature and mythology behind the creation of set isekais in Eastern literature, specifically Japan and Korea. Okay, we gotta stop talking like professors because I really want to get to other stuff.
I true, but I just want to say that there is also a lot of crossover in that. Like some of the earliest like big famous anime stuff was World Masterpiece Theater, which was them doing a lot of non-traditionally Eastern stories, but they were doing them in anime, but also a lot of traditionally Eastern stories in those too. But like Anne of Green Gables, Adventures of Tom Sawyer, like the early history of anime definitely was looking to anything they could for inspiration.
I agree.
And then you get into the weird cross-cultural, like incestuous thing between Westerns and samurai movies.
Oh my god. Yeah, let's not get too deep into lost into the cultural dive. Point being, we have some many examples in the West, many examples in the East, blah blah blah, all nice hugs, rainbows. Moving on. Sorry. I just don't want to get bogged down into this topic because you know it's deep.
Oh, it's very deep.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you, Seth, for sending us the email. We appreciate your thoughts. I have personally read the Emberverse and Nantucket series. I've not read Taylor Anderson's Destroyer Man, but I don't think I will because a lot of the alternate history fiction always bugs me because they get super wrapped up in trying to create these really complex other worlds that they forget that alternate histories don't necessarily have to be super different. I mean, you've seen there was this really great TV series based on a book series which I read about how Nazi Germany won World War II and Japan divided, and they divided up the US with Japan. I can't remember what the name of the series is, but it was on Amazon Prime, and it was really great. And it was just, I mean, there's hundreds of variations of that, but you can create simple divergences from singular events, and it can change the entire course of life just because of a few choices, because changes compound over time and get more complex the further out you get from the event. And I think that a lot of alternate history kind of bugs me because it doesn't really take that seriously, and instead gets wrapped up in creating like sentient dinosaurs, which could be lots of fun, but
I'm just saying, sentient dinosaur raptors are great.
Okay, we got another email from Kevin. Grim Toto. And Kevin answered a bunch of questions because he had to binge listen to four or five episodes. I'll pick one of the questions to answer. So a couple of weeks ago, I asked if anybody had like tales their family told about fae stuff. And Kevin says, "Fae stuff. While I am super Celtic by heritage, we, the family, didn't really tell stories about the fae, which show up in a lot. The only big things that I remember being told by the older folks is that you do not mess with fairy circles and beware of the lady in black. Fairy circles are mushrooms you can find growing in a circle. I know these logically ju are just the result of mushrooms growing around a tree and then continuing to do so after the tree is gone. However, I was told growing up they were portals to the fey lands, and the circles could only be created from the earth side. Destroying or ruining a circle will royally piss off the fey, as they now have less access to our world. The lady in black is Damorgan, a death-related deity. So I was told to avoid any women all in black. Oh, and not to use her name, which is why we call her the Morrigan instead. By the way, I respect that. I totally believe the Morrigan is real. There's so much about fae stuff that is so weird. Like that fairy circle thing, I wonder if it'll show up in. I mean, technically, it's already showed up in the portal stuff, right?
I am not 100% certain.
When I mean the portal stuff, I mean like the kids being transported into the world.
Yeah.
I assume that's how they got there, right? Like they used the same thing that the Fae did to get there, or some version of it.
I don't know. That's actually an interesting question, but there wasn't a mushroom circle, so probably not. And God, I just realized you do something like that might technically qualify as inviting the Fae in, and you just don't want that in your life.
Yeah, I know. So Kevin also says, love the new book segment. You dudes have already given me some new ones to look into. I know he's already super well known, but I recommend to everyone Michael Crichton. Specifically, The Lost World is so much better than the movie. Jeremy Robinson as well. He does great science fiction and fantasy, even if some of it gets a little heavy on the Christianity themes. It can be a turnoff for many. On the movie book note, I'm curious if you could cast anyone as the major characters we've seen so far. Eren, Ryoka, Horns, Lyskorians. Do you have any thoughts? I mean, anyone fictional or not. For example, if you think Idris Elba would make a good Calrissian. Mirabelle from Encanto as Eren, The Rock as Relk.
Okay, first off, the Rock as Relk is objectively the correct decision. If at any point in time this is ever made into any kind of media, I will petition and beg and crawl on my hands and knees across glass. The Rock is the only legitimate option for Relk.
I mean, what's the guy's John Cena? He could do it.
Okay, you're right. John Cena actually could pull off that affable, goofy, fun Relk, but I don't know. I'm a Rock fan. I watch everything he has ever been in and will ever be in.
The Rock feels more like a main character person, so I wouldn't put him in Ralph's position. I'd put John Cena in.
John Cena has better comedic timing than The Rock, and like Relk need. Anyways, I can go down that rabbit hole.
Okay, hang on. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, The Rock has technically been more of an action star and central prime person, whereas John Cena has played, like, built up his comedy chops before he started doing, like, frontman stuff. So he's more like, he feels more like a Relk to me.
I guess. The Rock also has done a lot of comedic stuff, especially early on. I have a whole thing on this. If anybody ever wants to, talk to me about wrestling, just ping me sometime. But I think wrestlers often make better comedic actors than, like, straight-up action movie stars, because a lot of the talents that make you a good wrestler and being able to sell and that back and forth lead to better comedic timing than you get for most other actors.
I would agree with that. A lot of times, what you're doing as a wrestler is the kind of things that improv comedians have to learn. How to shift your body properly, how to look at someone, how to react, how to say yes and. They do a lot of this because, it's a live show and they have to like adjust to the shit that's going on, and it makes them really good at like rolling with the punches, not to make a pun out of it or anything. But I don't really have any actors that I particularly would like other than maybe either Glenn Close or Jesus Christ. Okay, Glenn Close as Magnolia and Susan Sarandon as, or vice versa, as the butler, as Res.
I could see that, yeah. When I think about like who to cast as like Eren or a lot of the main people, I almost feel like if you wanted to do the Wandering in justice, you should like try and dig for lesser known or more unknown actors.
But do you have anyone in particular in mind?
No, I really don't. Like when I try and think of casting for Eren, my thought always goes to you need to find somebody relatively unknown. Same for like Leonette, especially because they're all so young. And a lot of the actors that are in my reference pool, I think of, are too old for them.
Maybe. You're right. We're in the aging millennial category, which, by the way, one day we've got to have a conversation about that whole stupid trope about millennials, because Jesus Christ.
I do.
What?
Oh, nothing. I was just trying to think of like who I would put in more of the side roles. Part of this problem is Knowles and Drakes are all going to take heavy makeup or heavy CGI, some degree of like having to disguise them, and that means you're probably going to want to look at central casting for most of them anyways, because character actors tend to act better through their makeup than a lot of like the stage mu or camera mugging movie star people.
Yeah, because they're not as dependent on their physicality and their, like, anyway, we're not going to get trapped at this, but so neither of us are particularly great at casting. Let's leave it at that. God, who was that actress from Death Becomes Her? I can't remember her name.
Meryl Streep?
Meryl Streep, thank you.
The Devil Wears Prada.
I know, but I couldn't remember her name in that one either.
You're gay.
I know who she is! I just couldn't remember her name! We've had this conversation about my name problems, okay? Why are you just calling me out every fucking time? I hate you so much. Oh, by the way, I heard this, like, I was reading this Reddit thread about actors who've, like, had great falls from grace. And somebody literally listed, not Meryl Streep, but her, what's the girl's name? God damn it. I'm doing it again. Who's the other actress in Devil Wears Prada, the one that was played the princess?
Oh, Anna Kendrick?
No!
No, that's not it. I have no fucking clue.
It's the, her, oh god, now I'm gonna have to Google it, because you're making me remember. It's
Anne Hathaway.
Right. Somehow Anne Hathaway's name came up in the middle of all of this. So, did Anne Hathaway have a huge fall from grace somewhere around the way?
I mean, she got that Oscar for Les Mis, didn't she? She was, like, one of the parts of that movie that, like, really worked, and I don't think she's been in much anything else since. I don't know, she's, like, a quintuple quadrillionaire or something, so who knows?
Yeah, she's just, like, ridiculously rich and has plenty of kids. She's, our life is set. Speaking of people whose lives are not set, that was a terrible transition, but we're gonna stick with it. TWI, chapter 247 and 248.
I thought we were doing 241 and 242.
Sorry, 241 and 240. Fuck you. Damn it. Why you gotta correct me like that? Gotta get me after me. It's because I had the wrong chapters.
Oh, I just wanted to make sure I didn't prep the wrong chapters. That would have been awkward.
Yeah, okay. Let's just do this because people are coming in the door and asking me to come. So, 241 starts off with Aaron deciding to make gravy.
Which is, you know, one of the greatest foods that God has ever given us, as long as it's the correct kind of gravy.
I've never really made gravy before. Is it like the way she was making it, isn't that like a roux?
No, gravy is basically a roux. Like, there's a couple ways that you make it, and I think this is brown gravy, which is the inferior gravy. But, oh no, this, she used bacon fat, flour. Yeah, no, this is like, you know, some of that good cast iron, put it on the biscuits gravy that we love down here in the South. It's literally like you fry up some sausage, you throw in flour, you put in some milk, you stir, you make a roux. It's meat roux.
Right.
Add in enough pepper to murder yourself. That's almost enough pepper.
So the balance of the chapter is focused on Ryoka. And Ryoka and basically everyone post, you know, having a lot of drinks like they did last chapter and getting super drunk and fucked up. So they all wake up, and after they've had the fairy flower drinks, folks warn Aaron not to start serving it all the time because it can be great, but it's also terrible. I think it was Drossi who straight up told her not to do that because it was, or it was Celis, sorry. Celis is straight up tells her not to do that because it's good, but it's like having too much of a good thing, you can get lost in your memories.
Yeah, it could be addictive.
Yeah, and it's just like another subtle warning that anything to do with the Fae always has a downside to it, even when it's okay. Just be careful what you do. But on the opposite side, so Ryoko wakes up and she's freaked out about the fact that she has to find something worth 50,000 gold pieces. And she goes through this itinerary of stuff. Printing press, telescope, guns. What would give Dolls 50,000 gold pieces worth of stuff? I want to just say this right now. Somehow nothing basic crossed her mind. Matches. Penicillin is relatively easy to produce once you know where it comes from. Aspirin. It's not that hard to produce aspirin. She dismisses a printing press, which is like, I don't know how to make a printing press. Do you think people don't understand how to make mechanical things?
I mean, a printing press could be interesting because it's not something we've heard about much. We hear a lot about scribes, and to me, a printing press is a great example of the way that the system could accidentally stunt growth. If you can level as a scribe and replace a printing press and turn a good profit doing it, who's looking to invent a printing press?
Anybody who has to pay a scribe.
Sure, but then you have to conceive of a printing press, as opposed to just a scribe like it's always been. It's the type of thing that could subtly get skipped over because the class system filled in a blank on your answer sheet.
Even if she didn't, like, have a mechanized printing press, she could still think about like the concept of printing as a thing. But you know, I get it. The Nulls don't want, like reading or whatever the fuck it is, so it didn't fit them.
I think that a printing press could have been fine. I think Ryoko was being dismissive of the Nulls right there. I also think, though, that like a lot of the other stuff you're mentioning almost feels like the kind of thing she takes for granted because it's part of her generic everyday life, and you don't learn about it that much in a history class.
It's just that I guess it made me think less of Ryoko because she didn't think of the commonalities between people, and she was like, I need something big and world-changing. Something big and world-changing comes from something simple, and it may not be immediately useful, but you start with basic concepts. And I have a reason for saying this, because in the middle of this chapter, she fucking figures out the basic concept from their side of the line, right?
Yeah.
Like, the thing that she offers them is the revelation that leveling in the singular class happens faster than if you have multiple classes.
Yep, in Dungeons and Dragons parlance, this is what we call a total character level versus class level. You need to hit total character level 13, and that takes a certain amount of experience. You're not, going from fighter 1 to 2.
Right. And they work out the concept of this. I did like the interaction between Gilbertich and Ryoka in this chapter, because Ryoka is not, like, most of the time she's taken seriously. She's like a paranoid idiot. And then she faces Gilbertich and realizes, oh my fucking god, more than one person figured me out.
Yep. Kilbukich is incidentally fucking adorable this chapter when he wakes up having had his first hangover, his first time staying out late, and then having to call his mom to call off the fucking search parties.
I guess. And then he also is like chillingly specific, robotic in his statements about how he's keeping things from the queen, and that there's like Eren is important to the hive and all that shit. And how much he considers the individual Intinium as to be important, which at this point we still don't really understand their significance outside of the fact that they need to exist, right?
Yeah.
Dude.
I'm agreeing with you. There's not much that like you've made a statement there, and I agree, and damn it, now I forgot what I actually was gonna say. I was gonna say something about this conversation between Ryoka and Kilbukich. Oh, yeah, the way that Kilbukich just like really immediately is being very trusting, and he has taken a lot of this good faith and trust that he has in Eren as this person from another world who is willing to give him a chance and can perform these astounding to him miracles just by talking to these people and making them individual. And he is giving Ryoka that benefit of the doubt that she usually precludes herself from with the way she treats other people.
It's also the very distinct truth that a god exists and that he's trying to kill said god, and so is this entire species.
Oh, yeah, no, that's what we call a revelation.
I love the fact that as soon as he mentioned that a god exists, he said, I'm gonna kill him.
Yeah, and considering the fact that every time somebody uses the word gods in this setting that isn't him, it's followed by or it's preceded by the word dead, it's possible, and you know what? Little bug man over there is gonna try.
And I do like the concept that Kilbukich is very much understands. Like, he establishes very quickly the idea that even speaking or thinking about a god as if it's alive gives it power.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Which leads into something like Pirate immediately references American Gods or and Small Gods by Terry Pratchett, which is American Gods by Neil Gaiman, Small Gods by Terry Pratchett. Both great books. And if you understand the reference, you understand exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, although I don't think it's quite the American Gods thing, because the American Gods thing was weird and complicated and involved bilocation, and I'm not even getting into it. Especially because if you haven't read it yet, you should. That and Anansi Boys, which is fucking spectacular. It is Neil Gaiman's best book.
Yeah, and in the context of this chapter, there is this. The usual pirate thing where there is a B plot and an A plot, and the A plot is dropping like revelations and big stuff while also being as simple as conversation between two people strolling through a city, and the B plot builds over in the background, and it's kind of the silly situation, and you get introduced to concepts in the meantime, like, excuse me, into new sceneries. Specifically, Kilbukich and Ryoko find the playground in Lisfor, right? The magically created playground.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really, really cool. And at the end of the chapter, Eren comes with a monstrosity that even Ryoko goes, like, it's the stupidest thing they've ever seen in their life.
It's hideous. It's horrible. It's beautiful. It's wonderful.
Yep, and I will not ruin the surprise until the next chapter, but what I suppose that was really it. It was very much a characterization chapter and a revelation chapter from a conversation point of view.
Yeah, we had a chance for Kilbukich to exposit a bit. Another big revelation that I don't think we covered yet, he knows who Teriark is. The Antinium even tried to pick a fight with him. The Antinium, have reconsidered.
That's another thing that seems to be like super common when it comes to the Antinium. They just don't really think of themselves as weaker than anything. And so the level of arrogance it takes to be able to meet just about anything and say, like, we can deal with this, it would be easy to say that they're overconfident and clearly not up to the challenge. But then you kind of think about all the stuff Kilbukich has said and how about how many times he's died and all the shit that's happened to him. And you kind of start wondering just how powerful were the Antinium on Rear.
They definitely had some muscle to them. And for more information on that, we do have our Antinium Wars chapter coming. We have some stuff we're splitting up and shifting for those and for some other stuff. But we'll get to that when we do, but we promise they're on the way.
Yeah. Things might be a little disheveled because of the COVID situation. We kind of have recordings all over the place.
But a quick recap of that is what they brought from Rear and what they invaded Israel with are not the same. That said, I mean, Teriark is a fuck mothering dragon. I'm still not convinced that if they had made it all the way over, they could have just kicked him over.
I mean, yeah, the things we find out. So Pirate Abba's note has nothing of significance for me, except that they said they got a lesson in humility and that they got kicked in the butt by the chapter, and this is a good thing to happen. I don't know what it's about.
This is a chapter that had a lot of exposition in it. It had some important character meetings and establishing characterization between how Ryoka and Kilbitch are going to interact. Even my first time reading this is one of those chapters that makes me dislike Ryoka because of how quickly Kilbitch takes her into his confidence. It feels unnatural for him. But I guess, at this point, Ryoka is spending Eren's social capital. That's the way that I kind of explain it to myself.
Yeah. And in the comments sections, there was mentions of things like steam engines and simple concepts like using a magnet to mill stone automatically. Like, you know how there's that whole thing where you can use two magnets to create like a pull function and then just, I don't know how to say this. It's the concept of how to create automatic milling, right? Without using animal power or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's just those simple concepts can lead to a lot of leaps in logic because that's what happened to our world, right? We started experimenting with like the basic forces of electromagnetism, and that led to electricity, and that led to the entirety of modern society that exists today. It's not like that. It seems like it's huge amounts of leap, but for a world with leveling and with people who are motivated to like challenge themselves and grow, you would think if Ryoko had thought of it, and she wasn't, okay, we're shitting on Ryoko a lot, but honestly, if anybody had thought of it, maybe they could have pushed towards it. Even just introducing algebra would have been a good thing, right?
If they don't already have. So, for me, there is a sort of hole here when it comes to their knowledge on that kind of thing, where a lot of times I say to myself, the wizards probably know how this works. You have this wizard school where people are very learned and there's a lot of advanced study there. They probably know what algebra is, and there's probably somebody out there in the world with accountant, mathematician, just something like that, and they probably are working on that kind of thing. It's just not the kind of thing that the average person's going to know off the top of their head, and might not matter that much to the gnolls.
There's also a lot of debate in the comment section about how Ryoko leapt from aging does not slow down your leveling to the level cap is 100. It was a huge leap in logic, and it didn't have a lot of basis in actual evidence.
I mean, 100 is a nice round number, and when you consider that, like, what we know of somebody like Nier's at this point, that he's kind of topping out somewhere in, what was it, the 60s?
Here's the thing, though. He didn't. He's actually an example of why she might be wrong, because he keeps leveling, right?
He does, but he also only has levels in a single class, so they're all sort of adding up. He is incredibly active because every time we've seen him, he's been involved in a war somewhere, and like he's still a ways off. 100's a nice round number. It's usually where you might find a cap in something like this. It feels like a natural sort of like extension.
Okay, now, you made me lose track of what I was trying to say about Ryoka's leveling. So she did make a leap in logic to the 100 thing, but I think that was a prose mistake on Pirate's part. Her argument was that there's a diminishing effect on leveling as you grow, rather than a diminishing effect from age, right? And the way the argument is phrased, it seems like she's saying the level cap is 100.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and I was trying to say, like, if you have lots of different classes and they don't quite consolidate, you can still be leveling quickly. It's just that there is diminishing returns with the actions that you're taking, right? The only thing I could think about is if every class requires some kind of push to level, something to generate XP, each time you level up, whatever that thing is has to diminish the amount you get for the next level, right? So baking a cake gets you one level in level one baker, but baking a second cake will not get you level two, right? You need to bake a more complicated cake or do a better job with the cake or challenge yourself or use different materials or something, right?
Yeah, or like maybe even say, well, you know what? I make cakes. I'm gonna make the king eat my cake.
Exactly. So it changes. The goalpost changes, and if the goalpost changes, then that means that the way to reach the goalpost gets harder, and the tools that you have to get you to that point. And that's likely what's creating that kind of downward leveling pressure.
Yeah, it takes a lot more experience to get from 18 to 19 than it took to get from 17 to 18, and for all the experience it takes you to get from like level 1 to 10, you add that again, you might get to like 12,
Exactly.
in like D&D 3.5 terms. And I don't think that there is a strict experience count in the same way in this setting, but I think that that theory of exponentially more, or not exponentially, linearly more being needed still applies.
Okay.
Could even be exponentially, fuck.
Yeah. So, wrapping up that chapter, we move on to 248, 242, excuse me. And in this one, it's all about Eren using the monstrosity that she created and Lynette's point of view.
Actually, I was going to say, just to start off with this chapter, this was the first chapter where I kind of didn't hate Leonette.
I would agree. This is when Pirate started to make Lynette, if not more sympathetic, at least help us to understand why she acts and acts out the way she does.
It gave her some depth, some actual like character to her previously sort of one-note snobbishness. I like her meditating on the contradictions inherent to Eren.
Yeah, and just the way she like logics through things, you begin to see the kind of lessons she would have taken and the knowledge she has and how she reacts to the world. Some things turn you off, but you realize this, if this is how you think of the world and the world doesn't fit that point of view, then you're obviously going to act out, right?
Yeah.
And that makes sense.
And like at the end of the day, anybody who has it in them to be, you know, not just kind to Mercia, but like we see in her internal monologue, her heart is broken to hear of the ch what happened to the child. Despite the fact that she's kind of a racist against gnolls, but she still sort of has it in her to try and be caring and kind to her. And that shows, you know, there's something to Ryoka, even if it's buried deep beneath the
So, the other thing that happens, I mean the A B plot thing again. Actually, there's like an A B C plot, but let's stick with that. So the A plot is Aaron taking out Torin as a living reindeer with a bunch of sled to collect stuff, and Leonette going with her, and they go collect some honey from some super dangerous bees.
Sled.
And along the way, and along the way, they meet the Fae, who like hearing about. Okay, this is my favorite line from the entire chapter. I wanted this to be highlighted, but they basically said that Rudolph's a mutant, that he probably should have been like pushed away from the group. Just saying, bah! He was an abomination. Toss right of the other reindeer to shun him. How bright was his nose? Bright enough to light up the sky? Who is Santa Claus? Okay, that part was a little sad. But I'm just saying, like he is a freak. He was a freak. And Aaron doesn't have a good defense for it, which is great.
It's because Aaron is telling the story like entirely wrong to entirely the wrong people. Her context is just completely out of place. And you know what? I want to talk more about that, but now that I'm reminded that the sled exists, I keep thinking about the bells. God damn the fucking bells.
Oh my god, the bells. I forgot about the bells. Okay, I just want to focus in on a little bit on Mar on the B part.
Bees.
Like, Leonette. Oh, Leonette knows the light spells. She knows a lot of little useful things, which is pretty good.
She does, and she seems to like be kind of torn herself, like, oh, I'm leveling. It's barmaid, that sucks, but I'm leveling, I'm getting things. She seems to like learning.
She does seem to like it, and it's just that. How do I say it? It's like you're breaking your indoctrination. She likes one thing, but then the rest of her mind goes, "No! How dare you? Stop it!" Like it's just so weird, and you begin to learn how she ended up like that later. But yeah, Leonette's just fucked up. Let's just leave it at that.
Bees. I just want you to know it's taking me a great deal of effort not to scream, not the bees, like I am,
I do not want to speak any more of the bees other than to say they successfully steal some honey. And they use poor Torin to do it.
Poor Torin.
Even I was sympathetic to Torin after this. Aaron is just like, oh my god.
Hey, Torin's great. He hates Leonette too. We're friends.
It is like super weird that Aaron keeps the gem from the snow golem's head. That was weird. I don't know if I figure out if she ever uses it again. But yeah, that was just so fucking weird.
It's the kind of thing I would keep. Like, now, admittedly, I'm conditioned by decades of playing role-playing games and computer RPGs to know that you never pass up on something shiny that drops out of a monster. Aaron's probably on a similar reference pool.
Yeah, and I do appreciate how the chapter eventually turns from what is essentially one of the most horrific experiences Leonette has ever experienced to tobogganing from the snowhill.
Riding a sled is a fun, glorious thing that I'm told you people that still live up north get to do more often than we do down here.
Oh, genuinely, the only time I've ever been able to do that. Okay, I've been skating twice, once to learn how to do it, and once to like enjoy myself. And I've been tobogganing once when in 1996, when there was a massive snowstorm, and I was young enough that we could do toboggans. There were these giant piles of snow, and everything was covered in snow, and there were just nobody was going anywhere. That was the one time I got to toboggan. I've never been able to do it since. It's because we live in New York City, which is on the coast, so there isn't as much snow.
True.
If I went up north, maybe.
Also, God, where would you even like? I once heard an anecdote from a friend in Boston that after a bad bit of snow, the mayor had to put out a thing saying, please stop trying to sled from your second story windows. But I don't even know where you would slide in New York City if you weren't going out of a window or something.
We're not like that cramped. It's Queens, not Manhattan.
It's very flat, though, still, isn't it?
No, Queens is actually pretty hilly. In literal, I think Queens is actually called Queens, or at least it used to be, because of the hills. There's a lot of hills. Let's just say, even I live on a hill. Like, when I look at the map that tells you if climate change will sink your house, my house will not sink because I live on a hill.
Well, congratulations on that. I don't know, like my experience with like New York City has really been very limited, and It just is always, my mental image has always been flat because it's mostly islands and it's mostly sea level.
That's just, it's just Manhattan. The other boroughs are reasonably different. But back to the chapter. So that was it. Did you like it? I guess I should say. Did you like these two chapters?
I did. They were, how do I put this? They don't exactly tie together thematically for us to say, oh, there's the overarching thing of these two chapters. But individually, they're both really strong chapters where we get some really cool character stuff and some new people interacting. New people meeting each other in the inn is my favorite part of Wandering Inn.
And even Pirate agrees with you, and they say, ah, back to form. I've missed this. Maybe it's a bit silly, but this is the story I want to start out telling. It's fine to have grand plot threads and portentous announcements, but sometimes you just need a snow golem attack and bees. Honestly, this is TWI. On the one hand, war crimes and significance, and the other, bees.
Hey, listen, the wandering encounter table cares not what your class is.
Yeah, that was the two chapters. There wasn't a lot of stuff. People enjoyed the chapter, I guess. And that's really it. I didn't find anything in particular from the comments to talk about.
No, like the first chapter gives you all the ideas and all the crazy stuff and all of like the world shifting, perspective widening stuff to talk about, and then this chapter reminds you what the core of the story is, and bees.
Yeah, and peace. Let's wrap it up. I think we actually have a reasonable amount of time. We have like 5 or 6 minutes left.
Yeah, if we have a few minutes left over, because we were talking about book stuff, and I think I even briefly talked about like how some of the books from that one series, the Hunter Harrington stuff, were free online. A few weeks ago, author by the name of Eric Flint passed away, who was a writer for the Bane Publishing Company, who was one of the people who pushed really hard for what's called the Bane Free Book Library.
It's one of the first electronic libraries that was available, and it was explicitly free. Bane was one of the first publishing houses to not have DRM, to introduce the idea of like EARCs and putting their catalog out there as electronic books. They were ahead of the time, Eric Flint included, in that respect. And really, they pushed the revolution for me. And for a young child, like, I talk about it so, like I was 300 years ago. It wasn't. But for a young kid who had no money, the Bane free ebooks was a big deal. I had a broken down ancient computer, even by the standards of the 2000s, and the only way I could get to books was through things like the Bane free ebooks.
Same, and like, I'm not gonna say that it's an entirely selfless thing they did. It's actually a brilliant business decision, way ahead of their time. But yeah, for somebody who was broke and couldn't really afford books and couldn't always make it to the library, because I didn't even have a car for the longest time, it meant a lot to be able to sort of get access to that free stuff. And since we had a few minutes left over and I couldn't find an easy time to bring it in otherwise, I just wanted to talk a bit about it because Eric Flint was a really cool guy. I also met him at Dragon Con. I talked to him by an elevator for like 20 minutes. Very cool.
Yeah, so it's the era of death, I guess, because a lot of actresses and actors and really cool folks are just passing on, and Eric Flint was one of them. And what do you, the rest in peace? Yeah.
Pretty much that, yeah.
Okay, on to the happier parts of. I was supposed to tell you about Catherine Addison's Goblin Emperor.
Oh, yes.
So, before we leave you, I will talk to everybody about this, and we'll keep talking at another. Dragging this after the recording, but so Catherine Addison came out. I actually don't know how many years it's been since the Goblin Emperor came out. Give me a sec. Her real name, by the way, is Sarah Manette, but she published it as Catherine Addison. And it came out from Tor Books, publishing house that I love, in April 1st, 2014. So it's been 6, 8 years since it came out. And it is truly one of the kindest books I've ever read, and that's the only way I have to describe it. Catherine Addison writes books that are genuinely more about the personal journey of the character than it is about any kind of grand politics. I mean, the world building that she has is very, very good, but it's like all of that melts away when you're reading about the person that's the main character of the book. The first book in this sort of Goblin Emperor world was Maya, the main character of the Goblin Emperor. And Maya is the acknowledged but unwanted youngest son of the Emperor of the Elflands. And he and his mother were banished from the capital because the Emperor didn't want his second marriage because he loved his original wife and didn't like his wife, who was a goblin. And he hated his son as well. And he taught his older children to hate her as well, and the son, and he banished two of them to, like, a terrible exile in the wilderness, where, along with a really abusive person, Sethrius is his name, but I won't describe anything more than that, because I don't want to reveal too much plot lines and things like that. So he's stuck in exile, and his mother passes away, and he grows old enough, and then he wakes up one day to a messenger, a royal messenger, arrives telling him that his father and his brothers have, and their eldest children and all that, have all died in an airship accident. And he's now the emperor.
Ooh, airships.
Yeah, so, exactly. So this is an interesting world that combines, like, steampunk developments with magic. A little bit of magic. It's very light magic and a lot of normal, logical things. And he travels to the court of the emperor and claims his seat. And it's all about his struggles as he reveals that he's essentially a kind person who just wants to do a good job. And he loves his mother and he's not really like some deep political evil. And he learns who his allies are and he finds friends and he deals with coup attempts and tries to find out who killed his family and is essentially an honorable person. And at the end of the book, you go through this whole journey with him and you get to feel like you're part of his life. And it just makes you feel so good watching him deal with all the shit that he has to deal with while also living through, like, dealing with his own trauma and all that crap. Like, it just feels good. And the entire series continues. There's a couple of side books about a particular character that comes up later, which I love because it's actually about a queer character, but not in the same way. I mean, this world isn't great, but I won't get too much into it, but essentially I love those books too. It's called Witness for the Dead, and the series is renamed as Cemeteries of Omalo. And it's much more contemplative and about your self-growth and recovering from grief and all that. God, it's so good. But the first book is just a giant hug, and I've always treated it as one of those things that you just read when you want a giant hug. And I thought, in these trying times, my personal trying times, I needed a hug, so I reread that recently.
Hell yeah, I will put that on my list. I've got like a month till None of the Ninth comes out, so I have time.
Speaking of like stuff coming out, do you have any books? I mean, you said None of the Ninth, but for me, it's like, Patricia Briggs has a book coming out. Shauna McGuire has a book coming out. Alona Andrews has a book coming out. All the authors that didn't produce books because the pandemic was driving them insane are now, like, releasing all of their books, and I'm about to feast!
Most of the stuff that I've been looking forward to has come out already in the past couple months. I think the last one I'm looking forward to is None of the Ninth, which around the time that comes out, I definitely want to be the book that I'm going to try and pitch to you to be the first book in this series called Harrow the Ninth, but we'll talk about that another time.
All right. I also have, like, Terminal B. Anyway, so that's my book of the week, I guess. Go check it out if you ever want a hug. It's not exactly unfamous. I mean, lots of people talk about it, but if you want a giant hug, it's cozy fantasy, just like everybody seems to love nowadays on our fantasy. But thanks for listening, guys, this week. Say bye, Dragonus.
Bye, Dragonus.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins,
edited by Discanter.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at NoKillingGoblin or email us at NoKillingGoblins with an S at gmail.com.